Bridge rideability may not get the attention that pavement does, but it's just as important. Brian Schleppe once again joins the podcast to discuss specifications of bridge smoothness.
Transportation infrastructure. It's what keeps our economy moving and gets people safely where they need to go. But maintaining safe, reliable infrastructure assets is a complex challenge that requires innovative solutions. I'm Nick Frank from Agile Assets, and I'll be your guide as we navigate through the complex and evolving world of infrastructure asset management. Every episode, you'll discover best practices, industry trends, and agency success stories that will help you improve your asset management strategies and get the most from your infrastructure funding. You'll learn how to save time, save money, and save lives while delivering safer, longer-lasting transportation networks.
My guest today is Brian Schleppe. Brian has served for more than 34 years at the Ohio Department of Transportation in a number of leadership roles. He started with the Office of Technical Services in 1990, which led to a career in the field of highway surface characteristics and vehicle interaction properties. He's worked specifically to improve rideability using IRI and is well known in the industry for his expertise in tire pavement noise, pavement friction and grip, and surface characteristics. Brian, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thank you.
Last time we talked about friction management and safety. Today we're going to talk about another topic that I know you have another big passion for, and it's bridge smoothness. So as we talk about that, what do we mean when we talk bridge smoothness?
Well, I think it's important to make a distinction within smoothness, right? And I always describe it by saying bridge rideability or smoothness in terms of rideability. So back in the day when we measured smoothness on bridges, it might have been with a 10-foot rolling straight edge, or it could have been with a profilograph. But those cover short distances and not really the full spectrum of roughness events that a vehicle feels. So rideability really is more about seeing or measuring or observing, if you will, the smoothness of that bridge deck or that bridge encounter as a vehicle suspension would see it. So smoothness, bridge rideability or bridge smoothness would be very little suspension movement when you traverse the bridge. A rougher bridge is going to have a lot more suspension movement. And one of the ways we do that is with this index called the International Roughness Index, or IRI. And I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit later.
I'm sure we will. So can you give us a brief history of rideability-based bridge smoothness in the state that you work, Ohio?
Sure. So it's fair to say, so I've mentioned IRI, or International Roughness Index, and that's something that we've been required to collect and report to Federal Highway for the Highway Performance Monitoring System on our pavements anyway, since somewhere back in the 90s at least. And we run the entire network and we report the data, and back then they would have us, when we would profile the road to get the data to generate the International Roughness Index, they would have us do that and mark bridges out or mark railroad crossings out or anything that were non-typical pavement items. And clear back in 01, we had all this profile data or IRI data on our entire interstate system. And we kind of always knew, right, that our bridge transitions or bridges were a lot rougher than our pavements. So we set out to quantify it. So we did a study and we found that our bridges on average were 2.5 times rougher than our pavements, and by measured by IRI. And that's very interesting because they represent only 4% of our interstate network by length, but they made the entire system average increase by 7.5% by including them versus not including them and just looking at the pavements. We did that study because, you know, the feds were measuring our highways based off, that was one condition index, and it represents sort of user satisfaction, if you will. And we looked at that and said, well, gosh, we we might want to do something about this. This is significant. And we did that before we were really, I guess 2001 was when we first started experimenting with IRI on very select pavement projects. So things rolled on. By 2009, our experimental pavement projects led to a standard IRI specification that our districts could choose to apply when we had construction projects. And then by 05 and 06, we had our first experimental bridge ride project where we used International Roughness Index for construction smoothness acceptability. About 2008, we did a holistic research project that looked at bridge type, bridge makeup, superstructure type, design, construction, maintenance, the life of a bridge, and all those factors and how they contributed to initial and long-term bridge rideability or smoothness. That resulted in that and some other work from our experimental projects. In 2012, we had a bridge rideability workshop. And by, that was early in the year of winter. And then by April of 2012, we had our first proposal note that was IRI-based smoothness specifications for structures, proposal note 555. So that's, and then here we are today. We just recently, I think January of this year, we did our first major tweak to that proposal note 555. So it went kind of through a revamp. But that's where we are today. And we've been using a standard bridge note since 2012.
So it's been a long process and a lot of work to get to the point that you are today. And so what have you seen are some of the benefits to improved bridge smoothness or rideability that you have seen?
Well, certainly number one is customer satisfaction. When you build a smooth riding bridge, a very smooth riding bridge, and as smooth as any new thick interstate buildup pavement where we got good smoothness, when you get into the lower double-digit IRI values and people ride across the bridge, you know, the DOT got phone calls and emails and contacted by John Q. Public, giving us an attaboy for how smooth those bridges rode. And they would stop the contractors at the local restaurants or the service stations. And they knew who the contractors were working on these projects, and they would give them an attaboy and a pat on the back. So that was a sign of success. So definitely customer satisfaction. But when you improve the rideability, you're going to get longer lasting pavement near the bridge and your approach slabs and your deck and even your superstructure, because you're reducing the dynamic load that those surfaces have to sustain when vehicles are transversing across them. Think of it this way. If you got the old spring scale, if you kind of easy slide onto it, it's going to bounce around a little bit, hover around your weight. If you jump on that bad boy, it's going to peg the spring and you're dynamically loading the scale. Same thing happens on a larger scale with bridges. So, you know, longer life because we have less dynamic load. And then they're safer. And that comes from uniform tire surface contact. When your bridges get sufficiently rough enough, or that bump at the end of the bridge gets big enough, you actually launch vehicles up. They may not lose contact with the surface, right? But you lighten the tire loads. And when you lighten the tire loads, you don't have uniform contact. So if you need to maneuver, you need to stop or accelerate or turn through that bridge, you're not going to be able to do it because you don't have uniform downforce. So it's safe, smoother equates to safer. We found in Ohio, you know, we have our snow and ice season, and a good bit of the state is in the snow belt off of Lake Erie. We get improved snow and ice removal. We have less equipment damage with smoother bridges. It makes a huge impact there. We're reducing vehicle wear and tear and damage, and reduce cargo damage. So those are just some of the things that we think the smoothness adds to the benefit on the benefit side.
And I would venture to bet, working in an industry like transportation where 90% of the feedback is negative, it seems, you know, oh, there's too much construction, there's potholes here, there's this. I'm sure that was such a great feeling to have people approach and actually send in positive notes that, you know, oh, this goes in the good bin now. These are notes we can put on the wall for the positives rather than the negative feedback.
Absolutely. I can tell you, you know, we did our experimental projects, right? And we had contractor A and contractor B on two different projects. And contractor A really didn't do anything different. They built the thing, and we had a provision to allow diamond grinding to see. We really wanted to see how much diamond grinding would improve the as-built product. But contractor B went out and actually met with us and talked about different ideas of how they could achieve smoothness before any correction. And contractor B, when the traveling public went across some of their final product bridges and they got all these attaboys, they were a champion for us at that point. And quite honestly, that was huge to getting more people on board, more contractors on board, more folks at ODOT on board with this bridge ratability thing. Because there's sort of a notion that, you know, bridges are supposed to safely sustain loads, right? And the fact that they should ride smooth is sort of maybe not an unintended consequence, but it's certainly not the primary thought, right? So it was trying to change the mentality that we can have a good bridge designed, built that safely carries a load, but it also rides smooth. Those should not be mutually exclusive. So that was a huge win when we started getting the attaboys. That really helped us promote a little more momentum.
I bet. And before you got those attaboys, though, there was a bridge that maybe was not as smooth or had poor rideability. So what were the main causes that lead to these bridges becoming less rideable and less smooth?
Sure. Probably the biggest thing is, you know, we have settlement and possibly erosion around our approach pavement, approach slabs near the back wall of the bridge. And over time, right, you're going to get more settlement because, you know, you build your back wall, you have this embankment that you've built leading up to the bridge, and then you have to excavate that out and so you can get that back wall built, and then you have to put material back in there, and that's what your approach slab sits on and some of your approach pavement. So it's that excavation of that embankment material, it's a lot harder to get compaction in there. And bridge designs have changed a lot since I've been at ODOT because they used to have scuppers along the bridge and you would get more of the water off all the way along, right? And go through sort of those kind of drainage systems. Now all the water kind of goes off the entire length of the bridge and has to be dealt with at the ends, which can be kind of a problem. And you're seeing more bridges that are integral or semi-integral, where all the movement has to be taken up at the back wall at the end. So those are kind of compounding factors to erosion and settlement. But basically, those approach slabs will settle, some of that approach pavement will settle, and you end up getting a dip and then sometimes a launching pad going onto the bridge. So less often, you will see residual camber in your spans, where you sort of have an upward arch between your spans or your supports below. That's not as common, but that can happen, and that can actually cause body bounce. In our state, we have a lot of closure pores or construction joints because on our interstates, for example, we have to maintain generally two lanes of traffic, both directions, even through construction. So you can construct one side of the structure, the deck, and then you get it finished, and then you move traffic over and you construct the other side. So you'll have either a construction joint or a closure pore, and there can be a lot of roughness associated with that, particularly to do with the hand finishing that goes on. So those are the sort of the major things. And one other thing that we found was, you know, we had a smoothness spec for our pavements. We had a smoothness spec for our bridge decks, but we really didn't have anything to cover in between, nothing to transition the pavement to the approach slab, the approach slab to the deck. And the pavement spec might've been IRI, the deck spec might have been a straight edge spec or profilograph. So that was sort of disjointed. So we kind of looked at a holistic approach through the whole bridge encounter to sort of correct that.
And then when you take that look, that holistic approach, what are some of the best parameters to characterize the smoothness of a bridge?
So that goes back to this international roughness thing and international roughness index. And that's seeing the roughness smoothness or the smoothness of that bridge the way a vehicle suspension does. And it goes back to, I don't want to see things that are going to move my vehicle suspension a whole lot. If it doesn't move much, that's going to be a pretty smooth ride. If it moves a lot, which is going to translate into higher numbers of IRI, that's going to be a rougher ride. So we do that by collecting inertial road profiles, which we've been doing it for decades now, but it's relative elevations every inch as you travel down the road in each wheel track. They're sub-millimeter accurate. They're highly repeatable and transportable all over the world. And basically, we filter everything out that doesn't affect a vehicle suspension. So we're filtering out longer grades and those sorts of things, but we're capturing everything that could move a vehicle suspension at highway speed. So we collect these profiles, we run them through the International Roughness Algorithm, and then voila, we have an evaluation or a way to track how rough or smooth that bridge is.
What are the limits? Are there some limits to which the smoothness specification can be applied?
Well, certainly. This was something we talked about early on when we were trying to craft a spec and use IRI. So when you think about the International Roughness Index or roughness in general, roughness or rideability, it's not really point data and it's not really length data. It's sort of a hybrid because if you say the IRI for this 10 mile project averages 70 inches per mile, you may get a concept for what a 70 means or how rough or how smooth it is, but you don't know, you know, is some of it rougher, some of it smoother? Do we have some isolated hot spots that are particularly rough? So at some point, if I have a really smooth deck and really rough transition points between my pavement, my approach lab, my deck interfaces, if that deck's really long, that can kind of average out those localized hot spots. So we ended up coming up with a term called the bridge encounter, which is 25 foot of pavement on either side of the bridge, inclusive of the approach slabs, the deck, and any joint systems in between. And we call that the bridge encounter. So that's sort of the bounds or the terminals that we put on it. And it really came from what would be different if the bridge wasn't there, right? And roughly, okay, people could argue maybe you need to go more than 25 foot away from the bridge. You have maybe some difficulties paving into the bridge or off of the bridge, but somewhere around there, that pavement's a little harder to construct or you've got different challenges, right? So we thought that was a fairly good cut, and that seems to have worked pretty well.
And when you're collecting this data, what is the time frame for doing it after the construction is complete?
So that's really the contractor's responsibility. In Ohio, when we have any smoothness specs, so IRI on our pavements or our structures, the contractors are required to utilize a certified piece of inertial profiling equipment and a certified operator. But the timeline's really up to them. Obviously, with a bridge encounter, you have to have your new deck placed, your approach slabs, and you have to have surface course pavement coming up to it, right? So that has to be built. It doesn't necessarily have to be striped and all those sorts of things, but those are the features you need in place. So it certainly has to be done before we finalize the project, right? But that's more in the wheelhouse of our construction project engineers.
And when you're kind of talking about some costs on there, are there negative or positive pay adjustments applied to those contractor payments based on your obtained smoothness?
So certainly for our pavements, that's the way we've been for a long time. We have positive and negative pay adjustment scales based off of smoothness. We had some support on the first round of proposal note 555 IRI for structures, but we didn't quite have enough. And honestly, looking back, it probably would have been easier to implement if there was an opportunity to gain some positive pay adjustments based off smoothness. So initially, our original version of 555, there were no pay adjustments. Our current version that just went into effect in January of this year, we have positive and negative pay adjustments opportunities. And really the reason we made the change, initially we saw bridge contractors building pretty smooth decks. And most of the time, if they didn't meet meet our IRI thresholds, it was a spot grind, right? Between those transition points of the pavement to the approach slab or the approach slab or the deck. And as time went on, I think we saw more and more contractors saying, well, I'm gonna have to bring a grinder in anyway. I'm not gonna try as hard to build it smooth up front. What's the point? And the fallacy in that kind of thinking is the rougher you build it, the harder it is to correct. And it's so much easier the smoother you build it. A lot of times you can build the majority, if not all, the bridge to come into spec without correction. Or if you do have to do corrections, it's a lot easier, right? So so we looked at how we could try to make it more attractive to the contractor to take more proactive actions, take more time up front in the construction process to build them smooth to begin with. And we think the positive pay adjustments might be the way to do that.
That makes an incredible amount of sense. Something my dad always told me when I grew up was, you know, put the time and effort in right away, do it right the first time, and then you won't have to go back in a month, 2 months, 6 months and fix it. You know, maybe spend more money up front, figure it out right away, and then you're not going to have these consistent problems down the line. I think that's a fantastic idea.
One of the things that I've learned, right, when we switched our pavement smoothness to IRI and then our bridges, right, contractors bid these projects. Time is money. They have a schedule they want to keep up. And they really don't have a lot of time, resources, or opportunity baked in for any, maybe little to no R&D, right? So I definitely get their perspective of, you know, trying to get in, get jobs done. So it does make it a little more difficult, I think, for the contractor to try to adjust to these new things. The way we've tried to combat that was shorten the learning curve for the contractors, whether it was our pavement or bridge smoothness. It was having workshops, working with contractors, experimental specs and those sorts of things to try to make that a little easier and then share what we've learned. But yeah, I agree. So many times we've seen if there's a little more time taken on the front end, it sure saves a lot more time, money, and resources on the back.
I've driven over bridges that are maybe 5 feet. There's bridges that are hundreds of feet. There are bridges that span miles. Does a bridge need to have a minimum length for your smoothness specifications to be applied?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is no. Our old version did make a distinction. So we had an overall rideability, an average IRI would have to be achieved if the bridge encounter was 265 feet or longer. And that went back to that notion where most often the largest concentrations of roughness are at the transition points between the pavement and the approach slab interface or the approach slab and deck interface. Now you can have isolated issues of roughness in the deck occasionally, but that's typically not what happens. So if your deck is short enough, but you still have these four transition points, you may not ever get that average down to something that will pass the spec, even though the transition points from a localized roughness perspective were within limits. So that's where we came up with that 265-foot limit, but we always applied a localized roughness criteria across the structure. Now, with a new version of our spec, there is no overall requirement. There is no minimum for the average. Everything is based off of a localized roughness histogram, and that's based off of a 25-foot continuous sliding base length across each wheel path of each lane of the bridge encounter. So we look at 25 feet, we calculate the IRI, we move it 1 inch down the road, we recalculate it again, and we do that all the way through. And then we have thresholds that cannot exceed. And now when we're paying positive pay adjustments, we do not allow the contractor to correct into positive pay. In other words, we want to reward them for building things as smooth as they can up front. And this histogram approach allows us to do that. So if they can build the bridge even after correction, maybe they have to bring a diamond grinder out or do a few things to touch up a few areas. But if they can build it to our IRI spec, we are going to make a positive pay adjustment to them based off of their pre-corrective smoothness. Anything that was below the limit or within the positive pay range, they will get credit for. So they sort of get rewarded for every opportunity that they took
advantage of to make any piece of the bridge smoother. That kind of makes sense.
You know, you've mentioned rough spots a few times, and no matter how well and smooth a bridge is when it's first built, eventually over time, whether it's 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, rough spots are going to pop up, you know, either on the deck or those transition areas. What are some of the remedies to address those rough spots?
That's kind of interesting because we traditionally, or back in 2001, when we did our interstate study, right, we did have very many smooth riding bridges from an IRI perspective. And once we started focusing on what we could do to have a smooth riding bridge encounter in terms of IRI at the time of construction, that's really important, right? Because another reason we did that Iowa State research was if you build it up and it's very smooth up front, but it doesn't last long, then what's the point, right? So you want to make sure your designs and your construction practices are such that you don't have a lot of settlement or erosion that's going to affect things. But things still happen. You know, if you build new alignments with big cuts and fills, there's a lot of propensity for settlement down the road. When those sorts of things happen, we've worked with our districts, and several districts now are doing in-house rideability corrections with their own operations staff. We will come out, we'll collect the project level profiles across the bridges. We'll give them a corrective action plan that's very detailed. We'll show them basically where we believe they should cut butt joints. We'll give them a variable depth milling plan, right? So take a little more material here, a little less material there, go down to this depth at this point, that sort of thing, right? With the goal of being able to put a 2-inch asphalt lift in, uniform lift in to level things up. Now, if things have settled a lot, and I've seen that in some cases, we'll even tell them how much they have to scratch and where an additional lift, right, so they can level things out. But that's the main thing that we've done, because typically once you build the bridge isn't going anywhere. And unless you have a lot of deck deterioration, if that deck is fairly smooth, most of your roughness over time is going to be from the settlements or the changes that are happening at the pavement and the approach slabs.
What did you do to implement your IRI-based bridge ride specs? You know, what problems, if any, did y'all encounter? And if you did encounter some problems, how did your organization overcome those?
That's a great question, because honestly, there was a lot of resistance, right? It was something new, it was something different. So it really comes down to how do you get people on board? And I go back to, you know, if a picture paints 1,000 words, then an MPEG speaks volumes. I started shooting videos of traffic streaming on smooth riding bridges where I could find them, or poor riding bridges. And I captured vehicles bouncing across a bridge or at a skew and would say, can you imagine what would happen if this is a snowy day or a rainy day and this bridge is on a curve with a skew and you're bouncing across it, right? And I've got videos where you see this box truck where the roughness is just tuned to that vehicle and the sucker bounces across the deck. And then after he gets across the deck, then there's a phase shift. And then you see the guy bouncing up and down in the cab after he's traversed the bridge. So those videos were huge. And the point I would make there is, at some level, this is intuitive to everybody. Anybody that's ridden in a motor vehicle across the bridge or on the road, right, they know what roughness is, right? I can't drink my coffee while I'm going down the road. I can't do this, can't do that, right? Or I get shook, right? And I even took videos of inside vehicles of what happens when you traverse a bridge and all sorts of things. Those videos spoke volumes and communicated the problem. And it was hard for anybody to deny it, that this would make everybody happier if we improved this. And so it sort of made it difficult for people to argue against it, that there wasn't value in it, right? And then we set about trying to figure out a way to address what were the problems, what were the causes. We had to find those. What were the things that we could do different from a construction or design perspective? And really, could we come up with reasonable and attainable level of smoothness based off of IRI? And I think we did those things with our Iowa State University research project, our experimental specs, working with our contractors. A big piece of it is how do you fix it if it doesn't meet spec? So we validated ProVal's diamond grinding simulation software. So ProVal is software that's used, that the feds kicked off and helped
help develop, and several states have jumped in via a pooled fund to help develop it. But it's got a smoothness assurance module where you collect a profile of a road, and then you can simulate running a diamond grinder across it. And it turns out that that simulation for the vast majority of the grinders out there is spot on. It's a reliable, predictable way to determine how much material you need to remove where and what the right quality improvement will be. So that was key. We had a workshop to try to communicate what was going on and how people could get past it, but there were still problems, right? You know, if we have jointed bridges with steel armor, if that steel armor is high in relation to the surrounding concrete, you've got a problem, right? Because you're going to have this bump that you just can't do anything with. You can't grind through it. And it's going to be an awfully tough sell to say, hey, you need to rip that out and try again. That's probably not going to happen.
Right.
So we focused on the things that we wanted to try to, certainly wanted to make sure we tried to avoid, and give them tools that things didn't work out right. The other problem we found actually was internal with some of our own bridge engineers. So some of our bridge engineers don't like the idea of diamond grinding decks. And there's really two schools of thought. You know, you want your deck impervious, particularly in the northern states, right, with chloride ions or salt, right, to get down. If you've got rebar in there, you don't want that salt getting to the rebar, even though they're epoxy coated these days and everything, right? You don't want the salt getting down into the deck. And the thought is that diamond grinding is going to microfracture the aggregate and the concrete, and it's going to allow more things. When you diamond grind across it, you're actually grinding out some of those shrinkage cracks. The main thing to think about is that diamond grinder is an abrasive process. It's not an impact process. So I really don't believe we're seeing the kind of microfracturing and causing durability and more cracks by grinding. But that was something that we had to try to overcome. And we tried to do this best we could, you know, by education and talking about these things.
You know, I'm trying to picture you in your work truck driving over a bridge with a cup of coffee, you know, filming yourself to prove your point that this bridge might need a little bit of work on it. And then sharing that with your coworkers. I'm trying to picture you doing that.
Well, I've been an extra for years on snow and ice duty, and I would have my routes where you're plowing snow. You know, when you come to a bridge, you need to slow down and you'd be ready to raise that plow up and get the weight off of it as you traverse the bridge. Now, some bridges, if they're nice and smooth and you don't have high armor or whatever, you can get through them. But anybody that's plowed snow in Ohio sooner or later has caught the edge through a rough bridge encounter. And I actually filmed that. I borrowed a truck from one of the garages that I worked for, and borrowed a driver, set up a camera and a tripod, and we've actually, it's probably the most famous video I've shot here in my career. But it shows in the cab what happens. And that was to make the point of, you know, when you're running 12-hour shifts and we're allowed to go 16 hours on the front end or 16 hours on the back end of a storm, but typically we try to run, you know, 12 hours or less on our shifts in snow and ice. But, you know, you're not working normal hours, you're tired, and even if you know your route well, there's going to be times where you forget, you don't slow down, you don't lift that blade, and wham. And I was able to capture that. And that made believers out of people. You could tell people when that happens, how violent it is and how much damage it does to the equipment. But when they see it, I mean, they literally gasp out loud. And making that point of how much damage that caused, not only the bridge, but our snow and ice removal equipment. The fellow that I was working for at the time out of the garage, he would have 10 units, right? With maybe a backup or two, but he would have 10 routes. And he says, on average, every storm he would have some kind of damage that would require repair to at least one of his trucks that was around one of these rougher bridges.
Video is a lot of times the best evidence to get people on board with an idea. And it leads me into my final question today before I let you go. With an increasing amount of public attention on a need for infrastructure improvements around the United States and even globally, Do you think we can expect bridge smoothness to become maybe more of an area of focus for transportation organizations in the future?
I think so. I'm a little guarded, right? Just because I know how many people and how many different perspectives we had to get on board to move forward with this. I joke with people, I pushed on the brick wall on bridge rideability for over a decade until I got enough people on board to where the wall started moving, right? It takes a lot of education. It takes a lot of people on board, all those perspectives working together to say, yeah, right? But I think so. From an asset management perspective, for sure. We know that smoother pavements last longer. It makes intuitive sense that smoother structures will last longer due to the reduced dynamic load. If you're customer service oriented, your customer satisfaction is going to go up, or user satisfaction is going to go up with these smoother bridges, or we wouldn't have got those attaboys, right? And it makes sense also from a safety perspective. If things get rough enough, it does become a safety issue. And think about the cargo damage. You know, look at this day and age of how many, you know, we are seeing our truck traffic increase despite the pandemic, right? Because everybody's ordering this. Now things are starting to ease off of the pandemic, but our truck traffic's not going down. Think about all the cargo damage that we can avoid by having smoother highways, smoother bridges. I think it makes sense. Yeah, I think we'll see more on this moving forward.
Well, Brian, I got another attaboy for you here for joining the podcast and sharing your expertise with us again today.
Well, I sure appreciate the time. Certainly bridge rideability has been a focus and a passion of mine for probably a couple of decades. And I love to talk about it. So thanks for having me on, and hopefully disperse some interest in some others to try to do the same.
Awesome. Thanks again, Brian.
All right. Great.
If you want to learn more about transportation asset management strategies that save time, money, and lives, head on over to agileassets.com. Once again, thank you to Brian Schleppi for sharing his expertise with us today. I'm Nick Frank. Join us again next month for another edition of Move Your Assets.